All right, Daniel chapter 1, and just a little bit of background on Daniel. So we start off in verse 1. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And so the book of Daniel and the life of Daniel is towards the end of the divided kingdom. And so the nation of Israel, for hundreds of years, had gone through this nasty cycle where life would be easy, and so they would neglect God, and then God would send them into captivity to some pagan slave-driving nation for a while, and that would make life hard, similar to their lot in Egypt. And so they would repent, and they would confess to God, and He would deliver them from captivity, and that would make life easy, and so they would neglect God again, and it would go on and on and on. Well, the book of Daniel represents one of those cycles. And so the divided kingdom, you had the nation of Israel, which was 10 tribes, and their capital was, does anybody know? It was Samaria, all right? And then two tribes had stayed together, and they were the nation of Judah, and their capital was Jerusalem. Now, Israel and the 10 tribes, they just had one bad king after the next. I mean, it started with Rehoboam, and it went down for, no, it started with Jeroboam, and it went down from there, and they had all bad kings, and so they ended up being sold into captivity or taken into captivity by Assyria about 130 years prior to the nation of Judah going into captivity to Babylon. And so they were already in captivity to Assyria, and what the Assyrians had done, and this isn't about the Assyrians, this is about Babylon, but I'm still going to share it for background information. What the Assyrians had done is they had a pretty good tactic. What they did is they intermixed all the people from the different nations and cities that they had conquered, and they kind of subdivided everybody, because that would kind of keep the various nations from uniting together to rebel against Assyria. And so what they had done is they had taken Samaria, which was the capital of Judah, and they had imported a bunch of Gentiles into Samaria, and those Gentiles ended up intermarrying with the Jews in Samaria, and that's where we get the Samaritans. And the rest of the Jewish nation hated the Samaritans because they viewed them as being Jewish half-breeds. And they kind of were, right? And so that's just a little bit of history there. But this isn't Israel. This isn't Assyria. This is the nation of Judah. This is the nation of Babylon. And it says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he besieged it. And so Judah had already been kind of like, what's the word I'm thinking of? Like a tribute nation to Egypt under Pharaoh Necho. And so for like 100 years, they had been paying tribute to Egypt. But Babylon came in and they conquered Egypt. And then they come over for Judah. Pharaoh Necho of Egypt had killed a previous king. And so he was controlling who ruled in Judah. And he had set up Jehoiakim as the king of Judah. And he was collecting tribute. So Jehoiakim was kind of like this weak, controllable king. He wasn't one of the good ones. And so Nebuchadnezzar comes in and Babylon comes in and they lay siege to Judah. And so I say all that to say, Judah's already a mess when Babylon shows up. And the divided kingdom is already a mess when Babylon shows up. And when Babylon shows up, they lay siege. Now, what does it mean to lay siege? All right? It means they pull a Joshua from Joshua chapter 6, and they set up all around the city, and so you're trapped, can't go anywhere. But instead of them marching around the city a whole bunch of times until the walls fall down, they just camp there, right? They starve you out. They cut off your water supply, they cut off your food supply, and they wait for you to get so desperate that either one, you're all dead, but before that, you get a bunch of weak, starving people that can't put up a fight, who are willing to surrender. And so it's kind of a, if you can pull it off, it's kind of a smart way to conquer a nation with minimal blood loss, right? You just kind of starve them out. You kind of thirst them out, right? And so Babylon shows up, and Babylon lays siege to Judah. And the sad part, well, we get to verse 2, and it says, "And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand," that's Nebuchadnezzar, "with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God." And the sad part of this siege is that if Judah had continued to follow God, or if Judah at that point had turned back to God, God would almost definitely have delivered them from this siege. And what a powerful testimony for Judah it would have been to see them resist successfully the siege of this huge empire and this huge military. See, there were other times where the odds were stacked worse, and God brought them through it. And so it's certainly not where God put them in a situation where he couldn't help them. He put them in a situation where they would be forced to turn to him, and they didn't. And so this siege, he gave them over. He delivered them to the Babylonians. It says that God gave them up to Babylon. And so this marked the beginning of a great exile from the land of Israel. And this was an exile that would take place in three phases. It would result in the destruction of the temple around 586 or 587 BC. And it was one that lasted for about 70 years. And so this is kind of the background of Daniel, right? Things are a mess politically. Babylon shows up, lays siege, it works. And now the nation of Judah is in captivity to Babylon. And we see actually a really clever plot from Nebuchadnezzar following this successful siege of Judah, and that's kind of what we're going to focus in on today. We're only going to look at a few more verses. We read in verses 3 and 4, it says, "And the king spake unto Ashpenaz." Now, Ashpenaz was the master of the eunuchs, right? Kind of a high-ranking servant of the king. "The king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored," right? They were liked, they were popular, "skillful in all wisdom," they were smart, "cunning in knowledge," right? These are educated people, "and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans." Now, that might not on the surface seem like a pretty clever plot, but it is. Because after Judah surrenders, King Nebuchadnezzar tells Ashpenaz, who's this leading official, right, this high-ranking official in Babylon, he tells him to bring back a certain group of people in the first phase of the exile. And he tells them not just to bring anybody, but he tells them to bring first young people who are of royal lineage and nobility, right? In other words, the president's kids, and the governor's kids, and the senator's kids, and the representative kids, and the college president's kids, right? Bring back members of these families who are well-known and well-respected, right? And keep in mind that this is taking place at a time when education would have been reserved for the upper-class families. So these families that Nebuchadnezzar is talking about are the families of kids who are receiving an education, and he's calling for them to come first so that he can indoctrinate them with his ideals. And if you think about it, what he's doing is actually a really clever strategy, because Babylon is the largest and strongest empire of its day, right? In fact, we're going to see in Daniel chapter 2 that with the exception of the kingdom of God that is coming to earth, right, Babylon is the greatest empire that has ever existed, right? And we're going to see that in Daniel chapter 2. And so this is this huge kingdom, and this kind of kingdom isn't built recklessly. And so as Nebuchadnezzar is taking siege and taking captivity these different nations, he's got to be smart about how he's going to do it. And so what he comes up with is this really clever plot. He says, hey, guys, or Ashpenaz, hey, let's start by bringing all the well-known kids with lots of potential who were just starting out educationally. Let's bend them to our ideals. Let's teach them how to serve and worship our gods. That way, when we bring the rest of the nation, right, when the rest of the nation arrives, we have a group of their people who are well-respected, well-educated, and we're going to let their people propagate our way of life with the rest of these exiles. So that way, when the rest of Israel or the rest of Judah comes, it's not our people trying to integrate them, it's their own people, right? We brought the young kids with all the potential, right? Their families are well-respected, they're well-known, and when the rest of Judah gets here, here's a group of your people who are going to help us integrate you into our culture. And that way, instead of having this volatile imperialism, you have a nation that you have one nation that integrates into another nation. And so that society as a whole grows larger with minimal fear of rebellion. And so Nebuchadnezzar actually has a really smart plan. It's very good plan. Well, we need to ask ourselves, okay, if I'm going to take this group of people who are already starting out educationally, right? They're already well-respected, right? They already have some education. They already have some presuppositions, right? How are we going to take an entire group of people and how are we going to indoctrinate them with a very different lifestyle from how they've started out, right? And so he comes up with a really good plan for that as well. You know, how do we bring a foreign nation in and get them to embrace our way of life? And he comes up with a really clever plan. We see that in verse 5. It says, "And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king." And so Nebuchadnezzar rightly recognizes that if you want to indoctrinate someone to your ideals, you have to get them to see the value of it, right? And so you have to get them to appreciate what you're offering. You have to get them to appreciate what your culture, what your way of life has to offer. And so what the king does here is he gets them to appreciate the Babylonian way of life by giving them access to all the finer things that Babylon has to offer. And keep in mind, up until this point, Judah has been paying tribute to Egypt. So even though these boys are noble, even though these boys are well respected or from well respected families, these aren't people who are necessarily super wealthy, right? Like, just because you're educated and well respected doesn't mean you're rich. And so he takes a group of people who are well respected, have a lot of potential. But for the last 100 years or so, they've been seeing, or not 100 years, that was Israel. For the last several years, they've been seeing, hey, mom and dad's religion hasn't really been working out for us. And then they show up to Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar goes, look at all that my gods have to offer. I have all this meat, I have all this wine, I have all this finery. Look at what my gods can do. Look at what I have to offer. And so it's really a very smart strategy because what he's presenting them would have seemed to them to be a high honor and a huge upgrade compared to what they would have been used to back home in Judah and Jerusalem. And so he says, look at everything we have here. Look at how our gods have blessed us. Look at how we're thriving. And so Nebuchadnezzar is a smart guy. I mean, he's being very systematic. He's going about this. I mean, he's got a very clever strategy. But there's something that he doesn't take into account. And what is that? That's the goodness of God. And the blessings that God promises are more than just material blessings. And unfortunately, there were only 4 men among that first group of imports that understood that, but praise the Lord for those 4 men, am I right? And we read in verse 6, "Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so the story focuses in on these four young men, and they're going to pop up a couple other times in this book. Obviously, Daniel, because the book's named after him, but his three friends are going to pop up a couple times. And every single time they pop up, there's going to be an amazing story of God's goodness and God's power that goes with it. But what's interesting is that we're told the names of these boys. It doesn't just say there were four guys. It tells us their names. And what's interesting is that in this day and age, your name was super important. And the kids that were born and the names that they were given, those names were given for a reason. See, these days, most people just pick names based on what they sound like. You know, some people name their kids after people. We did that with our kids. Our kids are named after people. Some people name their kids after people. Some people just name their kids' name because they sound cute, right? They sound nice together. But in this day and age, people's names were picked based on what they meant. And so your name was assigned because of its meaning. And so these four names are actually really significant. Daniel, or Danielle, which is the accompanying name, means God is my judge. El is a reference to Elohim, and he is the God of Israel. Israel, right? And so Israel means God is my judge. Does anybody know, or Daniel means God is my judge. Does anybody know what Israel means? No. Pastor Jim knows. What does Israel mean? It's basically the idea of one who contends with God. And Israel certainly did that a lot, didn't they? But Daniel means God is my judge. And so it's a reference to the God of Israel. Hananiah means Yahweh has been gracious. Now, Yahweh is the name of God that was given to Moses at the burning bush, right? Who should I say has sent me? Yahweh, right? And Yahweh means I am, right? It's a reference to the self-existent one. Well, actually, it's he will be, but it's I am, right? I am that I am. I am has sent me unto you. And so that Yah, Hananiah, that's a reference to Yahweh. Yahweh has been gracious. Then you have Mishael, right? You get that El again, reference to God. And Mishael means who is like God. And then you have Azariah, you see that Yah at the end, a reference to Yahweh, and it means Yahweh has helped. And so all four of these names are names that are a daily reminder to these guys of the God that they serve. Well, if you want to indoctrinate a nation, these names just aren't going to do, are they? All right, you can't go about indoctrinating a nation by daily addressing someone by a name that's a reminder of the God that you're trying to deprogram, right? And so these names aren't going to do. So Ashpenaz actually gives them new names, and it's all part of the indoctrination. It says, unto whom, verse 7, the prince of the eunuchs gave names. For he gave unto Daniel the name Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and of Azariah of Abednego. And so all four of these names are interesting, and all four of these names are part of the indoctrination. Belteshazzar means may Bel protect his life. And Bel is one of the false gods of Babylon. Shadrach, that Ak, is a reference to the god Aku, right? And it's the command of Aku. Then you have Meshach, same thing, who is like Aku. So instead of who is like God, you have who is like Aku. Whoops, I went away from it. Instead of God is my judge, you have may Bel protect his life. Instead of God has been gracious, you have the command of Aku. Instead of who is like God, you have who is like Aku. And then Abednego is a reference to the god Nego or Nebo, and it's servant of Nego. So instead of Yahweh has helped, now you're a servant of Nego. All right? And so all of these young men that Ashpenaz brings to Babylon, we don't know how many of them he renames, but he at least renames four of them, these four. And so in the face of this indoctrination, and it's a clever one, all the way down to the assigning of a new name, where every time I address you, I'm reminding you of the gods that I'm trying to indoctrinate you with, of all the young men that Ashpenaz brings to Babylon, Only these four are ever named in this book, and it's because, as we're about to see, these four men make a decision that all the rest of the young men that came with them didn't make. And so seemingly, the plan, the indoctrination, worked with every single young person that came into exile except these four. And we read about their resolution. We read about the decision that they made. We read in verse 8, it says, "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself." He recognized that the indoctrination, right, if he were to give in to those things, that would be a point of defilement. He says, "Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the prince of the eunuchs, this guy Ashpenaz, that he might not defile himself." And of course, we're going to learn as we continue on with the passage that his three friends join him in that resolution. And what's interesting, and maybe this is off topic, but what's interesting is that we refer to Daniel as Daniel, but we refer to his three friends by their Babylonian names. Maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we should call them Ananias, Mishael, and Azariah instead of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But that's my hobby horse there. But Daniel made up his mind, right? He had already decided. It was not up for debate. It was not up for discussion. Daniel had already made up his mind and decided that he was going to do what was right no matter what. And of course, we learn in the next few verses that his three friends join him. He decided that he was not going to succumb to the pressure to do what everybody else was doing, right? And so here we have a young man from a nation that did not honor God, living in another nation that did not honor God, yet he made up his mind that he's going to honor God. And so that decision, as you know, is going to set the course for the rest of his life. And we know that God is going to use him powerfully to change the atmosphere of Babylon for good, and it's going to culminate in Daniel chapter 4 with Nebuchadnezzar, which is probably one of my favorite narratives in the Old Testament. But Daniel's decision, Daniel's purposing in his heart that he's not going to defile himself, that's going to set the course for the rest of his life. That's going to set a course of powerful change in the atmosphere of Babylon that's going to have far-reaching not consequences, but effects. There you go. And so God is going to use him powerfully. All right. And here we are, you know, a couple thousand years later, and we're still talking about this. And so I want to make a few points here. And so if you want to continue filling these out, you can fill these out, because we need to connect with the life of Daniel. Right. See, God has given us account of the life of Daniel for a reason. And there's something that we can learn. And so I want to make a few points here, and then we'll do some discussion, and then we'll sing and then go home. We need to realize that, like Daniel, we live in a world that doesn't want to honor God. Right? Prayer is no longer prominently featured in our government or our schools. There's been a variety of movements over the years to strike out the phrase "in God we trust" and even to remove the words "under God" from our pledge. Instead of saying "one nation under God, indivisible with liberty and justice for all," there have been various movements over the years just to say "one nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all." And I could preach a whole message on that word "indivisible," but I'm not going to do that. But over the years, there has been a lot of movements, a lot of things going on, even in our country, to remove God and to not honor God. You know, everyone in our world wants to do what's right in their own eyes. Everybody wants to be the God of their own life. Everyone wants to be able to define their own truth and be whatever they want to be. And so we need to be careful, because like Daniel, we live in a world that doesn't want to honor God. A second point of comparison is that we live in a world that wants to indoctrinate us with its ideals. Right? The world has an agenda for us, just like Babylon had an agenda for Daniel and his friends and the rest of the well-respected kids. Right? The world has an agenda for all of us. The world promotes perversion under the guise of individual liberty. You can be what you want. You can do what you want. You can say what you want as long as it doesn't offend me, right? Everybody can do whatever they want. Everyone gets to define their own truth. And what's true for you is true, and what's true for me is true, and don't step on my truth. What's interesting is that they'll step on your truth for the sake of telling you not to step on their truth. But anyways, we live in a world that doesn't believe in absolute truth, which anytime someone says, there's no such thing as absolute truth, I want to say, are you saying that's an absolute truth? But anyways, the world despises God. And the world despises the things that God values, and so the world is actively seeking to undermine the things that God values. The sanctity of human life, the sanctity of marriage, the freedom of worship, right? All these things the world wants to undermine. Well, God values life, and so the world undermines life, and they promote abortion. And they promote individual liberty, and they promote choice. And the world wants to indoctrinate us into thinking that my rights are more important than God's laws. And that's just one example, so we need to be careful. But the world we live in doesn't honor God, and the world is actively seeking to indoctrinate us with their ideals. And they are doing it, number three, by bribing us with their pleasures. And so we need to realize that, like Daniel, we live in a world that wants to bribe us with its pleasures. Right? You know, Daniel's not here tonight, but Daniel's a pilot. And from what I understand, and Daniel could confirm this, from what I understand, anytime a pilot gets in their airplane to do their pre-flight check and all that, one thing that they absolutely have to do is they have to calibrate their compass. And they have to make sure that their compass is calibrated. Because if their compass is off by even 1 degree, if you're flying from Greenville to the south side of California, you might end up in Portland, you know? And so it's really important that pilots calibrate their compass because they have to make sure that they're staying on course. Well, like the compass of an airplane, Satan understands that if he can knock us off course by even 1 or 2 degrees, the result could be a Christian who is way off course. In fact, it can result in a Christian who is so far off course that he may not even know where he is. Right? How many of us have ever gotten lost because we listened to GPS when we shouldn't have? Right? The world wants to highlight the importance of living in the moment. They're all about their parties. They're all about their concerts. They're all about their movies. They're all about their celebrity lifestyles, right? Everybody wants to be a celebrity. Everybody wants to be an influencer, right? You know, you go on social media, and it's ridiculous what people will do on social media for a couple of clicks. I mean, it's like, it's degrading in my opinion, but they like it. You know, everybody wants to be a celebrity. Everybody wants to be an influencer. Everyone wants their platform to be able to show off, right? The Academy Awards, they give out all these arbitrary awards in a variety of meaningless categories, and the winners aren't based on any measurable metrics or standards. It's just kind of whatever, right? Parties aren't inherently sinful, but sometimes there are sinful things that takes place at them, right? Concerts aren't inherently sinful, but sometimes there are sinful things that take place, whether it's the music, whether it's the lyrics, whether it's, you know, the rest of the culture that's there, you know, alcohol, drugs, sexual immorality, all that kind of stuff, right? You know, the devil and the world will take things that on the surface may not be inherently sinful, but they use that to kind of desensitize our palate and indoctrinate us and bribe us with their pleasures and knock us off course. And so we need to be careful because we live in a world that wants to bribe us with their pleasures and in so doing, distract us away from doing what's right. And so this brings me to number four, which is kind of the whole point of this message, and that is this. Like Daniel, we need to decide in advance what we're going to do when the opportunity to sin presents itself. See, it's not really a question of whether or not it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And so like Daniel, we need to purpose in our hearts now, today, that we're not going to give in to a world that doesn't honor God. We're not going to give in to a world that wants to indoctrinate us with its ideals. We're not going to give in to a world that wants to bribe us with its pleasures. Like Daniel, we need to decide in advance what we're going to do when sin presents itself, because we know it's coming. Proverbs 22, verse 3 says, "A prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself. But the simple," or the not the foolish, but the non-prudent, right? Kind of the blissfully ignorant, the simple pass on. And what's the result of that? They're punished. And so like Daniel, we need to decide in advance what we're going to do when sin presents itself.